The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, welcome in a beautiful Monday in Pittsburgh in Western PA. If you're listening to The Ride Home today from other climes, I mean, I hope it's as nice where you are as it is where we are. I am Kathy Emmons. I'm on my own today in the studio because John Hall's taking a day off, but I am not alone because Lexi Merritt is on the other side of the glass, both here with you today up until 6 o'clock p.m. Looking forward to a great ride home today, inspired by all the vitamin D I'm getting. Lexi, you as well?
Yes, I walked outside for a little bit after I ate my lunch, and it felt so beautiful.
I mean, the high amazing. Today was like 64 degrees.
And it was incredible for every minute that it was 60 degrees.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour of today's program, very much looking forward to a conversation with Jake Medor of Mere Orthodoxy, which is a publication perhaps some of you are familiar with. We're talking about the misunderstood reason millions of Americans stopped going to church. That'll be a couple segments in our second hour today. Also in that hour, our good friend Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor back with us. She's saying pets aren't people. Now, it's interesting coming from her because Karen is a huge animal fan. So I bet we'll talk about her pooches. We recorded this conversation before the weekend started. And so you'll hear John's voice on that as we all kind of talk about our animals. But how do we rationalize a society where it seems like a lot of people spend more money on their dogs than they do on their kids, or choose to have dogs instead of kids? Anyway, good conversation coming up at the bottom of the 5 o'clock hour. Also, Lexi, this might be disturbing to you, but I want to be the first one to tell you that scientists have made a 7-ingredient 3D printed cheesecake.
That sounds like a crime.
There's no possible way that can be good. I'm not sure why that would even be attempted.
Yeah, I don't know why, but I wish they wouldn't. Sometimes I think scientists need to stop and think about if they should do things.
Right, like the Meta.
Yeah.
I also saw a story today about how people, general employees around the country are excited because they believe that AI could help them get farther ahead in their careers, but they're frustrated that their bosses won't teach them. And I thought to myself, why are we all so sure that AI is going to help us get ahead in our careers?
I hate to be the one to say it like this, but I think AI is going to take your job before it helps you in your job.
That's exactly what I thought.
Which sounds so stupid to say, but also I don't love AI. So.
Me neither. Anyway, ChatGPT will be weighing in on that conversation. Anyway, in the 4 o'clock hour, your hair looks gorgeous, Lexi, but it cost what? A shocking article in today's Washington Post about how much women are paying to get their hair done. That's just like dipping your toe into the water, into the stream, Lexi, of today's Ride Home. So before we get any further, I think, speaking of stream, we should let the water flow because it's time for the top four at four. It's Monday. It's March 25th, 2024. And man, it is nice out. Number one. The planet, and by the planet I mean ours, was just slammed with what government officials dubbed a severe geomagnetic storm, the second highest level of the rating system about such things. The event brought a major disturbance in Earth's magnetic field, could you tell? It may have impacted infrastructure and made the northern lights visible farther than usual. Coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are when a large cloud of plasma and magnetic field bursts from the sun's corona. This particular CME exploded along alongside a solar flare on Friday. More flares are possible through Wednesday. And this morning, officials said that the impacts of it appear to be weakening. Moderate geomagnetic storms can potentially impact high-latitude power systems, damage transformers, and they will extend the Northern Lights, are you ready for this, to New York, Idaho, and Alabama. I mean, would that be cool to walk out of your house in the evening in Alabama and see the Northern Lights? It can also potentially require flight ground control to issue corrective actions for orientation. That's from CBS News. Number one, thousands of Christian faithful attended Palm Sunday celebrations yesterday at Jerusalem's sacred Mount of Olives, marking the first day of Holy Week as conflict surges all across the region. Pilgrims waved branches and palm fronds in the air as the Israel-Hamas war rages in Gaza. The conflict, though, appeared to have had little effect on the procession, which swelled to a similar size as last year, despite the fact that tourism on Israel has been devastated since October 7th. Jennifer Whedon was interviewed for ABC News. She traveled from the U.S. for the occasion and said, quote, "I am here because I love Jesus Christ." Number three. Speaking of Palm Sunday, Pope Francis decided at the last minute to skip his homily during Palm Sunday Mass at St. Peter's Square, avoiding a strenuous speech at the start of a busy Holy Week that'll test his increasingly frail health. He's hobbled by bad knees and persistent respiratory problems, but Francis did participate in several things related to the Mass. He did bless the palm fronds and olive branches, but he'd been expected to deliver a homily halfway through the service. The prepared text had been distributed to journalists, but when the aide presented Francis with his glasses to start reading, the Pope made it clear that he could not deliver the remarks, though Vatican officials did not explain why. The Pope is 87 years old. Francis pronounced prayers through the service, offered a long appeal for peace at the end of the Mass. He said he was praying for the families of those killed in what he called an inhuman attack at a suburban Moscow concert hall. Also asked for prayers for the martyred Ukraine and people of Gaza. Vatican officials estimated some 60,000 people attended the Mass. Read more about that at ABC News. And number four in local news, Coach Mike Tomlin says, quote, "He prides himself in creating discomfort for myself and others." When asked about trading Kenny Pickett to the Eagles, Mason Rudolph to the Titans, and receiving both Russell Wilson and Justin Fields into the Steeler locker room, Tomlin spoke yesterday at the NFL annual meeting, which opened at the Ritz-Carlton in Orlando. He said, quote, "I'm fundamentally against comfort." And that is your top four at four. I like it. For the fourth consecutive season, I'm reading here from the Trib, and of course we all know this, the Steelers will have a different quarterback under center when the season opens. Tomlin said Russell is in the pole position. So looks like if Justin Fields is going to overturn that, he's going to have to do exactly that. From the conversations with Justin, said Mike Tomlin, "I know he's excited about learning from Russell and maybe learning some of those veteran tricks of the trade." I do believe, though, Lexi, that Justin Fields is a decade younger than Russell Wilson.
He is indeed.
Is that true? Is it 10 years?
Yeah. Just about.
Uh-huh. That's a lot. Anyway, okay. Time for us to take a break. When we come back, our good friend Greg Clugston will be with us, SRN News White House correspondent. We'll hear the news this week in the nation's capital. Stay close. It's the Monday edition of The Ride Home. Well, if it's a Monday, that means that a conversation with Greg Clugston is in the works. Greg Clugston is the SRN News White House correspondent and speaks to us live from that location. Greg, welcome in.
Well, thank you, Kathy. It's always good to be here on a Monday.
Well, there's a lot of stuff happening on this Monday, especially for Donald Trump. I mean, it's like I have to keep, you know, a window open on my iPad so I can see all the latest developments here. Okay, so the first news is that Mr. Trump's Manhattan criminal trial on charges that he covered up a sex scandal is going to start on April 15th, even though the former president wanted to delay. Give us the details, Greg.
Right. We had mentioned a week ago at this time that there was this document dump from federal prosecutors. And so the state prosecutors and the Trump defense team all needed a little bit more time. And so the judge in the case agreed to delay the start of the trial, which was to have begun with jury selection this week. And so we didn't know until today what the upcoming schedule would look like. But the judge announced today in a ruling that this hush money case will begin on April 15. So another 3 weeks or so. And so that's going to move forward. He essentially said that there's going to be enough time for the former president's lawyers to go through these documents that they received just within the last couple of weeks. And he also suggested that really, even though there were tens of thousands of pages of these legal documents, that really only a very small number of them were specifically relevant to this case as it stands right now. So, in other words, this case is moving forward, and April 15 is when that jury process and the trial process for that particular case will begin.
So it seemed from what I was reading today, Greg, that the judge was, I won't say outright accusing, but agreeing with the prosecutors that it basically was a document dump, as you called it, and that only maybe 10% of all of the rafts of paper that were added to evidence really had any bearing on the case.
Yeah. And of course, the district attorney in New York, the office there, did agree with that assessment coming from the bench. They said that there was really little new material in the documents, even though some of the papers were being delivered by federal prosecutors, and it's the state that was bringing this case. So obviously there was overlap on these issues. But again, the Trump legal team did get a delay in that case, which was seen as a victory for the former president and his lawyers. But they will have to be ready here in 3 weeks or so when that next process step begins with the jury selection.
Did you read, Greg, any of the interchange between the judge and one of Mr. Trump's lawyers, Todd Blanche? It seemed like the judge was particularly dissatisfied with the way Mr. Blanche was, I don't know, conducting himself in court. At one point, apparently, I think I'm reading, yeah, this is from the New York Times. He said, listen, how long have you worked as a federal prosecutor? You know any details about that?
Yeah, there was some interesting back and forth. And, you know, this judge and a lot of judges in various cases, not just Trump related cases, often speak very bluntly and very directly to lawyers and other participants in these courtrooms. And it's always very interesting to, if not hear or see, you know, video or audio, but at least read the transcript of these comments. And, you know, he was basically saying to the Trump team a couple of things. One, if you had a real problem with not getting these documents, which apparently were requested months and months ago, why did you not repeatedly come to this court and to this judge and say, hey, we haven't gotten these documents yet. Why wait until the last second? So and then he was also essentially saying that you're accusing the New York District Attorney's Office of prosecutorial misconduct and some other allegations which the judge said he simply did not agree with. So, again, very blunt and very direct and also very interesting for those of us reading about that interchange.
Also, good news for former President Trump that it looks like all of his assets won't be taken by the courts as he's forced to pay the bail or the bond. Pardon me. So talk about what the former president will have to pay and how he and his legal team skirted what looked like it could be, you know, financial disaster.
Right. This was this $454 million civil fraud judgment. And today was the deadline for him to put up what everybody thought was going to be that amount in bond. And we were hearing from Trump and his legal team late last week, Kathy, that they simply were unable to come up with that amount of money for a bond, that they were getting refused from various organizations that would perhaps provide that service, and that they were running into kind of a cash crunch in terms of what was liquid and available for Trump and his team to put forward. But today, as you mentioned, it was good news for the Trump team. This New York appeals court agreed to hold off on collecting that total amount of $454 million and essentially said instead of that $454 million, Trump can put up $175 million in a bond within the next 10 days. So he still has another week and a half to pull that together. So that was certainly welcome news for the Trump team, because he, as you well know, probably, and your listeners know, he was very unhappy with that judgment. And even today in a statement of saying it just goes to show how ridiculous and outrageous it was from his perspective to have a bond of that size, of that dollar value, which he said was essentially unprecedented. And he again claimed that he did nothing wrong. But going forward, they will have to come up with this money.
Speaking of unprecedented, Greg, I mean, you and I could spend the next dozen hours detailing all of the situations that he's involved in legally. This has never happened with a former president or a presidential candidate. And of course, we've got an election coming up in November. Mr. Trump's certain to get the Republican nomination. I mean, how do we even think about these things?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Kathy, that, you know, if you were, you know, a year or two ago, or, you know, longer ago, certainly, but, you know, put up the prospect, you know, before all of these indictments came along, to suggest that you would have the presumptive presidential nominee for one of our two major political parties facing these many federal criminal indictments and dealing with a court calendar that is overlapping with the political election year calendar. And then to say that he is still someone who is in the lead in many of the polls against the incumbent president of the United States. I mean, it's just and I think because of, you know, how we gather our information and our news and the kind of stories that Donald Trump has created and been involved in for several years, it slowly has not been as strange as a lot of people might think it is. But when you really look at what is going on and what the country is facing and what Donald Trump as a presidential candidate and a former president is facing, it's all very strange in that sense. And I think we're a little numb to it in some ways. But when you really, you know, look at the facts and the situation right now, it's a very, very strange situation.
Sure is. Greg Clugston with us, SRN News White House correspondent. Greg, let's turn our attention to the president. President Biden came out right after the October 7th attacks, and he was firm in his support of Israel. He traveled there. I have heard, you know, I'm sure you've read so many statements of people from Israel who were so incredibly grateful. We like, you know, President Biden more than we like President Netanyahu. I mean, just, you know, incredible gratefulness on behalf of the nation of Israel. But now, you know, we fast forward 3 months. He's getting a lot of criticism from the most left-leaning portions of his party. Talk about how that's affecting his discussions. I was going to say negotiations, but I guess that's really not the most appropriate word to use. But how are things going between he and President Netanyahu?
Yeah, there's clearly increased tension in the last few weeks, in particular, between the Biden administration and Netanyahu and his war cabinet. And it all has to do with the war strategy that is impacting and affecting civilians in the Gaza Strip, because there have been a lot of civilian casualties there as the Israeli Defense Forces have continued to target Hamas. And the way Hamas is so embedded within the civilian life and culture in Gaza, it's very difficult to go after Hamas without having those civilian casualties. And of course, there's a dire humanitarian situation, as essentially you've got cities that have become large refugee camps as people have clamored there for safety and for, you know, any sort of, you know, food and supplies and shelter and that kind of thing. So it's very dire in that sense. So what has happened is there has been talk that the Israeli forces are going to go after this city of Rafah, where is housing many tens of thousands of these civilians, essentially refugees. And there's great concern about what that military offensive would be like. And so that is what the White House has been very vocal about, Kathy, in the last couple of weeks, saying that the U.S. would be very, very unhappy with Israel going forward with that plan. And they invited top Israeli officials from Netanyahu's government to come here to Washington, and they were going to be meeting here today. Mm. But at the U.N., the Security Council just passed a resolution with the U.S. abstaining, and the U.N. Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire. And so in protest, Netanyahu said, okay, we don't like this pressure coming from the UN Security Council. We're not going to send our delegation to Washington now and talk with the Biden administration. So the tensions are still running really rough right now.
Well, you know, Biden's getting it on all sides when it comes to to the Israel-Hamas conflict, as is anyone who's speaking up right now on either side. So talk about domestically, though, how he's faring. It looks like we're not having a government shutdown. It looks like that has been averted. Talk about how that negotiation went.
Yeah, it came a few months late, but Congress finally got its act together in the sense of passing through the House and then the Senate a budget funding bill for the remaining government agencies that had not received a new budget. And of course, the budget year begins the 1st of October, and here we are at the end of March of the following year. So there was several months delay. It was kicked down the road several times. Of course, the GOP leadership in the House is very shaky in terms of the margin of advantage that the Republicans have over the Democrats. It's been dwindling because there have been a number of recent sudden retirements and people resigning from members of the House Republican Party and leaving Congress. So that number is dwindling. But all having said all that, the House and Senate late Friday and early Saturday went ahead and passed that budget. President Biden signed it. So we have the threat of the partial government shutdown over for now. So Congress is off for the next 2 weeks on their Easter recess. So we don't have to worry about that. But, you know, the other thing that the White House is really wanting lawmakers to tackle is this emergency security bill that would send more funding to Ukraine and Israel. And the president would also like some sort of border compromise for our U.S.-Mexico border crisis with the migrants there. But that's been a real sticking point. Those negotiations fell apart last month. And so there's no sense that's going to happen anytime soon, especially in the next 2 weeks since Congress is out on vacation.
Greg Clugston with us, SRN News White House correspondent. Greg, our time is short. And so I need to ask you something that, of course, is not news related whatsoever before you leave. An article in today's Washington Post about the rising cost of haircuts. And of course, that's not really affecting men as it is women. But I do want to tell you that the reporter who wrote this article is a woman for the Washington Post, and she spent $398 on her last haircut and color. My question for you, Greg, have you spent something in this realm for a haircut you've received?
No. I'm just trying to think how many months or years it would take me to reach $398 for hair care.
So less than that.
Yes, significantly less. And I know that women's, you know, the prices for salons and getting their hair done has always been, you know, different and more expensive than men.
Right.
But that is an extraordinary amount of money.
And isn't it?
Would be hard to justify in my budget.
Right. So I'm guessing then you've never gotten dimensional blonde extensions.
No, I got talked out of them one time.
Is that right?
I have not gotten them.
Okay,
yes.
I understand. Well, if you are tempted in that regard, maybe you should just call in and we can talk some sense into you.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
We're always here for you. That's Greg Clugston, SRN News White House correspondent. We're grateful to Greg for joining us every single Monday on The Ride Home. We need to take a break. When we come back, what is this? $398 for a haircut and color? Come on. Well, I wasn't lying when I was having the previous conversation with Greg Clugston. Today in The Washington Post, the reporter whose name is Trisha Romano. That's
there
what it is.
There she is.
Trisha Romano says that over the pandemic, she did what a lot of anxious and bored women did, and she messed with her hair. She bleached highlights and toned them. She watched about 20 million YouTube tutorials. She thought she had it down. But after a while, she realized that she had this stubborn orange undertone she could do nothing about. So eventually, she gave up, went to a salon, and then they told her she was going to need color correction. So Because of that, she would be charged by the hour. So she says, quote, I sat in the chair and anxiously watched the clock as if it were a meter in a taxi. The stylist stripped the semi-permanent gloss with a special treatment, added highlights and lowlights, and gave me a haircut and a blowout. I steeled myself for the bill, which was $398.
Oh, that hurts.
She said the results were fine, though certainly not life-altering. Now, that is a staggering sum.
As soon as she said color correction, I felt it in my heart of hearts. I knew it was going to be expensive.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so my hair specialist is Amy, and we've been together for a long time. And so when I go every 5 or 6 weeks to get a cut and color, it's somewhere around $100.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Lex, do you go to a salon? Do you do it yourself? Do you not do anything at all?
I do little to no hair cutting. And if I do, I do it myself usually.
Okay. Awesome.
I try to save a lot of money.
There you go.
And then when I get bored, I go to Sally Beauty and I buy too much hair dye.
Exactly.
And I ruin my own hair.
I was going to say, and things can go really wrong.
Yeah.
At that point.
Right? I've stained a tub one too many times in my mother's home.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So the article in the Post goes on to say that hairstylists are giving themselves a salary bump. They say it's long overdue because of how low their salaries have been. In fact, I have a figure here. The median annual salary for a hairstylist in 2022 was $33,400, or about $1,606 an hour. Pre-COVID, it was even worse. It was $1,254 an hour, or $26,000 annually. So this salary bump, they say, is long overdue. They're charging $100 an hour for cuts, color, bleach. Others are billing for more basic services like a blow dry, toner, you know, whatever that is. Professionals are saying that the old model of like a stylist working on two people at one time, you know what I mean? Like doing a cut on one while the color sits on another one or whatever. They said it's too much. They skip lunches or breaks. They work 10 or more hours to fit clients' last minute scheduling needs. And all this is unsustainable. I have to say, in watching my friend Amy, who's done hair for a long time, they truly have a crazy day. Their work day is nuts. And if you're a guy and you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, crime, listen, I can promise you that if you looked at women who work in a hairstyling salon, they are hoofing it every day. So look, I'm not saying that people who do hair are like on the front lines of military combat, but I am saying for them to get a raise, I don't think it's too much to ask. I really don't. However, there's a lot between, you know, what I pay and $398.
That's so much money.
Okay. So have you ever done color correction, Lex?
No, okay. I've never really used box dye before, which is like the main culprit of ever needing it.
Right.
But if you wait say you do box dye and then you wait 6 months, you're fine. You can go in and you shouldn't need a color correction. They're just going to have to do a little more work on you. Recently, I dyed my hair and I decided to go to a salon and I paid $190 to get purples and blues in my hair. And, you know, she did a whole bunch of stuff to my head, but it was that's a lot of money. $190 is nothing to sneeze at,
that's
my friends.
That's so much.
It's so much. It looked very nice, though.
I bet it did. We need to take a break, though. When we come back, Calvin Troop will be with us. He's the president of Geneva College. I might ask Dr. Troop if he's ever gotten a $398 haircut. What do you think?
His answer might be similar to Greg's.
It might be. Anyway, we'll talk about the dynamics of public speaking next on the Monday edition. You're along for the ride home. If you ask the general public what contributes the most to stage fright or to some type of anxiety, the number one cause is public speaking. Now, that's funny because you think, okay, people could be afraid of nuclear war, or they could be afraid of, you know, disease, or, you know, we're talking about the solar flares that are going on currently. But most people are terrified by public speaking. And so, you know, all of the adages, well, you should picture everyone in their underwear, which is the most useless. I can't imagine why that ever helped anybody who was standing up in front of a group of people. But people have all sorts of strategies for it. But it's something that affects each one of us. We watch people who are our elected representatives speak to us. We watch our pastors on a weekly basis speak to us. We hear people on the radio speak to us. So what are the dynamics of public speaking and what do we need to keep in our heads? We've invited Dr. Calvin Troop to be with us. He's the president of Geneva College and adjunct professor at Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Dr. Troop, welcome in.
It's good to be with you. How are you this afternoon?
Well, I'm fine, but I was hitting the wrong button.
Well, you don't have to worry because you're not actually looking at people. You're just speaking into a microphone, so you don't have to be afraid.
Did you ever have that type of anxiety? I can't possibly speak in front of a group.
Oh, absolutely. And the good news is you can learn to overcome it.
Okay, so when you were suffering from this, tell me, were you a kid, teenager? Were you already on your way in your professional life?
Well, actually, I was on my way in my professional life, but I had had speech classes and done okay in them. But the actual experience of speaking in front of people when something matters means that it's always a performance context. And so it raises our heart rate and our breathing rate and our nervousness.
Yeah, it's so true. When we talk about public speaking, especially in a Christian context, a lot of people think about preaching, right? They think about the sermon they hear on a Sunday. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable linking the idea or the word performance with that kind of speaking. We were just talking about that on Friday's show. Can you talk about how you look at that? And maybe for people who aren't used to public speaking, how those two things can exist together?
Yeah, well, the first thing we start with is this basic biblical understanding that as human beings, we are made to speak to one another, and that many of the most important things that we do when we're in good conversations with people is what we want to transfer to a public speaking environment. So it's not something entirely new. People often think of public speaking as doing something completely different than they've ever done before, but we're actually designed by God to be able to speak, and not only to speak in person in conversation, but also to speak in public.
Mm-hmm. And so that word performance, does that connote artificiality to you?
Not at all. I was a high school and college athlete. A lot of people have been involved in athletics in a number of ways. And so I think about it and help people to think about it as the difference between actually just practicing and playing a game. When you get ready to start a game that matters to you, things elevate a little bit. But once you get into the game, if you're trained and you've practiced and you're prepared, then you can actually enjoy what you're doing. But it takes a while to help people learn because you can't just step onto a platform and have that kind of experience.
Right. For sure. Just like playing a game, you know, I like that analogy. There are a lot of practices that happen before the game happens, but there's also a lot of other things. There's weightlifting, there's nutrition, there's cardiovascular training. There's all sorts of other fundamentals that go in before you can even get to the practice level, before you even get to the game. So talk about some of those other things that people have to kind of get ready for before they can even start to practice to get better.
Yeah, one of the things that we work on, and this is one of the things that I teach constantly at whatever level I'm teaching, is that you begin to use other speaking experiences that are not public speaking experiences to kind of work in the things that you're wanting to teach speak about, so that when you get up to speak, it's not the first time you've thought about it or worked on it. As you're speaking, one of the big mistakes we make is we keep writing things and writing things and writing things, but our hearts and minds work differently when we're speaking than when we're writing. And sometimes writing over and over again or trying to memorize actually gets in the way of having a meaningful conversation in a public context.
Yeah, and that's what's difficult. I've done a lot of public speaking in my life and career as well, and it's difficult to be on stage and also be thinking clearly at the same time. I find that to be the biggest challenge. I can be very prepared and deliver something, but it's it's different to be in the moment. And I think that's what denotes a real pro. Talk about your experience with that. Do you see it the same way?
It's actually what you're describing is very true. And everyone is equipped to do that kind of thinking. And that's why the training is important. And so when you can process how, when you're driving, you can be thinking of four different things at the same time as you're actually driving and not be a distracted driver. And you can think of context where you actually have to be thinking of more than one thing at the same time. This is one of the reasons why it's good to do some practice with visual aids, even if you're not going to use a visual aid in a speech, because when you're practicing with visual aids, you're thinking about how to change the slide or how to move this object or that object while you're speaking. And this is one of the reasons why impromptu speaking exercises are so important, because when you have a short time to prepare, you can't have the whole message prepared. And then you stand up and, wow, you can actually speak intelligently while you're thinking about what you're going to say next. It's actually a built-in capability God's given us, but you have to get used to using it.
I love that. I can't wait to hear the details of what you see as preparation. Dr. Calvin Troop is with me, president of Geneva College, also adjunct professor at RPTS, Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Okay, Calvin, start us with the building blocks. If you're in front of a group of students and you're talking to them, what are you saying are the very first things they need to know about public speaking?
First things I do is get them on their feet speaking. Because and when you go to school, most of what school is about is learning how to read and write and do math and those kinds of things. And then you get into junior high and high school and professors ask you to get up and speak, but you haven't had much training. You got to get on your feet. We do impromptu speaking exercises. We think about how to tell a story, because stories help us remember what we're saying in quite a bit of detail. Now, you can go out, you got to practice. So you got to tell a story that's too long for a while and then learn how to rein that in. Mm-hmm. But the principles that go into telling stories match how audiences hear and respond and understand material. And so you have to use what I call story forms. You don't always just tell stories. But people in action are very interesting. If you read the Bible is full of people doing things that we can then remember, right, without having to look it up. We might not remember every detail, every verse, but you know what happened with David and Goliath. You can kind of go through the whole story in your head. And it's that kind of knowledge that works best in a speaking environment.
That's really good. So if you said to me, you know, hey, Kathy, tell me about Esther, I would have a pretty easy time relating that story, because it's been such a, I don't know, it's such a formative story. It's an incredible story in the Old Testament. So that the same familiarity I have with the Esther story, being able to know, you know, who the characters are and what happened when and whatever, you're saying that's the kind of prep I would need to get up and tell a story effectively in front of people.
Yes. And if I ask you to say, what are the first three things that people have to know if they're going to go on the air? And I said, but you have to tell stories about how you messed up or how someone trained you.
Right.
You could pull them. You have
sure
great
could.
Knowledge
sure
that you could explain.
Right.
So if I asked you to write it all down first, though, you get into all kinds of details that you'd worry whether you'd remember them or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. So So having the really, you're saying having the big picture, right? Having the story in your head is what's so essential.
Right. Basic principle. If you can't remember what you're going to say, how do you expect listeners to remember it?
Right. Okay. Well, what about the line that goes between people are listening to you versus people are remembering what you said?
Well, that's what we're always working towards. Right. And we want to use oral patterns of thought so that what we say is memorable. So, for example, how do you talk about what it means to be faithful in marriage? Well, my grandfather taught me this. How did he teach me? When I was 5 years old, my grandmother, came down the stairs of their little frame house in Akron, Ohio, and she was one of the most godly women I've ever known, and she was swearing like a sailor. And I looked at my grandfather, and he's not correcting her. He's not troubled. He's just leading her down the stairs. And I said to my mom, "What's going on?" And she said, "Grandma has what was then called hardening of the arteries." And within a month or so, Grandma was in a nursing home.
Wow.
And every day I was at my grandfather's house, he took me with him to the nursing home to be with Grandma. And I saw him care for her to the point where she could only remember his name and her name. And when I stood up at the altar to take my vows, I understood what in sickness and health meant because my grandfather taught me.
Because you'd seen it.
I'd seen it. Now, when I tell that kind of story, when I'm speaking with young people at Geneva College about what marriage means, what is Christian marriage, they'll remember that story. And they'll remember in sickness and health. And they'll remember details, because when I tell the story in a classroom context, I add other details. And they'll remember the details in ways that if I gave them three bullet points on marital fidelity, they would never remember.
Remember, sure. I am so sorry to tell you, Calvin, that our time is already up. I would love for you, and this, of course, is how radio works. But I would love for you to come back and join us again and talk about this. Because as I said, that fear of public speaking afflicts so many. And so if there was a way out, you know, if there was a way that people wouldn't be trapped by that, I mean, I think that would set a lot of people free. That's Dr. Calvin Troop. His book is called The Spoken Word. You can look for that. It's a Geneva Press book. And Calvin, I definitely look forward already to next time. It was on Friday afternoon that John and I and Lexi watched Catherine, the Princess of Wales, disclose online that she had a cancer diagnosis. News comes today that she and her husband, Prince William, are, quote, extremely moved by the global response to her cancer diagnosis. Kensington Palace said this in a statement on behalf of the couple and reiterated their plea for privacy right now. They went on to say that the palace won't be releasing any additional updates about Kate's situation and, again, put forth a plea for privacy. I thought Kate did a terrific job in what she said on Friday. Lex, did you feel the same way?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. It's so hard to imagine living that type of life. And I know that they have a kajillion dollars and I know that they can buy whatever they want. But the bottom line is that we're all human and we all suffer anxiety and fear and illness and dysfunction and all of that. And so to have all of that in the public eye is just, it just makes me cringe even thinking about what that's like. King Charles spoke out. He said in a statement also that he was, quote, so proud of Catherine for her courage in speaking as she did and has remained in the closest contact with his beloved daughter-in-law in recent weeks. Prince Harry and Meghan, for their part, also weighed in. They said that they wish Kate health and healing and privacy. And British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said that Kate has the love and support of the whole country and that Kate's video post on Instagram had more than 5 million likes. When Kate talked, she didn't specify what kind of cancer she has, which is fine. I mean, the people who are obsessing over all these details, I just really feel like they need to focus on more in their own life. But anyway, the princess also did go on to say that she is in the middle of a course of chemotherapy.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Welcome back to the 5 o'clock hour on today's ride home. It is a gorgeous Monday in Western Pennsylvania. And whether you're in Western Pennsylvania or you're listening from some other place in the country or world, I'm so grateful you're along for today's ride home. I'm Kathy Emmons. I'm here alone in the studio today because John Hall's taking a day off, but not alone because Lexi Merritt is joining me producing the program so ably on the other side of the glass. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to look forward to a conversation with Jake Meter in just a couple of minutes on the misunderstood reason millions of Americans stopped going to church. He says that the defining problem driving people out is, well, it's not a big deal. It's just like current life in America. We'll talk about that in a bit. Also, our good friend Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor with us around 5:35. We're talking about pets. Are they people or are they just animals? Or maybe is there something in between? Looking forward to that conversation as well. But before we do any of that, check this out. NASA has sent discs depicting the essence of humanity to the moon. Now, this is a story I'm happy to tell you about. But for you to get the real picture of it, you have to look it up online and see the photographs. Sapphire discs, which have been etched with what they're calling the essence of humanity, are going to be sent to the moon under NASA's Artemis program. And they're looking at it as kind of a repository of human knowledge. This is a product which is titled Sanctuary on the Moon, and it includes a bunch of stuff. And if you look at the article that I looked at, which is from ABC News today, also I saw it on the Telegraph today, you can look at what the discs are like. And the stuff that's on them is just really fascinating. It would be like if someone asked you, okay, so you need to come up with things that depict the whole history of humankind. I mean, it seems like that's a lot of things. So mathematics is included, culture is included, paleontology, art is included, science. Also, they've attached the human genomes of a man and a woman. They mimic the golden phonographs that were sent with the Voyager spacecraft, which were the first ships to leave the solar system. That one had greetings in, I don't know, like 50 different languages or something. There were messages from world leaders. I think there was a human heartbeat attached. These discs are different. First of all, they look different. But second of all, they have different content. NASA's Saturn V rocket, the schematics for it are included. Also, the lunar landing modules that took American astronauts to the moon on the Apollo mission. They also have paintings included by Da Vinci and Van Gogh, the Declaration of Human Rights. There are celestial maps. There's data on anatomy, astrophysics, particle physics, phases of the moon. I mean, they are very, very cool. A disc titled Space is one of the 24. And just the visual of it is artistic and beautiful in and of itself. This is the quote by the people who have put this together. We believe that this internationally curated repository of knowledge on the moon will serve as an inspiration today and for many generations to come. As I said, the only way that you can really grasp what this looks like is to see them. They're saying it's going to be kind of a cosmic hello to our descendants or perhaps even visitors from elsewhere. And so they're looking at it very long term. There are 24 discs in all, one pixel for every Homo sapien who has ever lived on the planet. I mean, it is absolutely fascinating. Read more about that at today's Telegraph. We've got much more to come on today's ride home. Stay close. Coming up next, why have so many people stopped going to church? Maybe you're one of them, and maybe you might identify with some of the stories you're going to hear in just a bit. So stay close for today's ride home. Just this past weekend, I had a get together with my best friends from high school. No, they aren't just my best friends from high school. Two of us out of the five met in first grade. Another two of us met in sixth grade. And then we all met each other in ninth grade. So we've been friends for a long, long time. And in talking over lunch on Saturday, the topic turned to churches. Because one of the things I think that probably attracted us as likely friends, is that we were all churched. We were all from different churches. So there's a Methodist in there. There's a couple Catholics in there. There's a Lutheran in there. And there's a Presbyterian in there. But all of our families were regular churchgoers. Now, fast forward all these years to where we are now. I guess the miracle of it is that all of us are still regular churchgoers. But one of the things we talked about is how unusual it is when you look at us in relation to all of the other friends that we grew up with. And we had a wonderful community growing up. And it's not that no one goes to church anymore. But what's more interesting to me is that fewer people go to church, but more people say they believe. So it's interesting to see the disconnect between people who say that belief in God is an important part of their life, except going to church isn't. So how did we get there? Well, to talk about this and other issues, I've invited Jake Meter to the show today. He's editor-in-chief of Mere Orthodoxy, also author of In Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World. Jake, welcome in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
All right, Jake. So you heard my story about my friends from high school. This is not an unusual situation, right? We've got a ton of friends that we grew up with who all still say they believe, and yet church is just not something they do.
No, it's not. There's actually, I don't know what you're looking. Ryan Burge is a sociologist.
Good friend of ours.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So we're probably thinking of the same studies.
Yep.
Then. He's shared some really interesting data recently that actually kind of contradicts a lot of common wisdom about religion and politics in the U.S. Because what he found is that on the American right, and I'm going off in memory here on the numbers, but it was something like 55% of surveyed Republicans he spoke with said religious belief is important, and only about a third said going to church regularly is important. But then what was interesting on the other side is that what he found was with the left, church-going progressives are actually far more engaged politically than secular progressives. And so I think in both cases, you see this very odd relationship to church where it's, I think, on the right, more of a kind of cultural identifier, mm-hmm. and on the left, it's more of a political accelerant. But in neither case is it really what I think, like, Scripture would expect us, what church would be for us as Christians. So, yeah, it's a sad but very interesting kind of cultural trend that we're seeing now.
Jake, in your article for The Atlantic, you referenced the book The Great Dechurching by Jim Davis and Michael Graham with Ryan Burge, mm-hmm. who we already talked about. Mm-hmm. So I've read this book. You've read this book. Probably some of our listeners have read this book. But the numbers in it are really shocking. So 12% of the population have stopped attending church just in the last 25 years. And that's the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history. So whether you're a Christian or a churchgoer or not, this is such a societal change that it's worthwhile that we pay attention to what's going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you actually put the number to it in terms of people, it's almost more shocking. It's about 40 million people.
Wow.
Whose practice has changed. And as you said, this is the biggest shift in church-going practice in American history. And significantly, all the prior shifts were people who weren't going to church who started going. So you think about, like, the Great Awakenings, or there was a spike after the Civil War. There's a spike after World War II. This is the first really big shift of that sort that's going the other direction with people leaving the church.
Yeah. And so it's worthwhile, especially those of us who follow Jesus, to ask why that is. And, mm-hmm. of course, there's a whole book that listeners can read about this, about what the ideas of Jim Davis and Michael Graham and Ryan are and the data points that he brings up. We've talked a lot on the show about church abuse, about people who have had wretched experiences in the church. And so I don't want to gloss over any of that because it's vital. It's especially vital that we repent of any of those situations that we've been involved in or just kind of let slide. But I think the biggest surprise is that most people haven't left church because of those reasons. It's for something much more, I don't know, like regular and uninteresting.
Right. The single biggest behavior that they could identify as driving dechurching was moving. And the broader trend that they saw is basically when people go through a major phase, change in phase of life, that is often when they would dechurch. So it's when somebody graduates high school and moves to college, or it's when somebody graduates college and moves to a new first job, or when somebody gets married and now their lifestyle changes, or they've got kids and their lifestyle changes. Something happens to disrupt their routine, and church ends up getting dropped amidst the disruption. COVID would also obviously be a major one here, right, because that snapped people's church-going habit in a very direct, sudden way.
Right.
So, it's the ordinary day-to-day stuff. And they actually do discuss, they call them casually de-churched versus de-churched casualties. So mm-hmm. they discuss both in the book, but the larger group is the casually de-churched.
Yeah. So you brought up one of the composite characters from the book, a 30-something woman. She grows up in a megachurch in the suburbs. When she goes to college, she's heavily invested in the college ministry there, which a lot of college students aren't. So that certainly shows that she's interested in being engaged. But when she graduates and moves, as you said, to a full-time job, she meets a guy who's less religiously engaged. And despite that, they get married. And then, of course, they have kids. And then somewhere in that time in life, they stop going to church. So maybe they're just super tired because children are exhausting. Or it's just easier to stay home. Maybe they have access to digital church or whatever it is. But the bottom line is that even though she started out that committed, she ends up not committed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And so maybe she'd end up in that same category, Jake, of somebody that I grew up with who would say that they still believe. It's not like they've had a crisis of belief, but they are having a crisis like of church.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And so the thing I'm trying to draw out in the piece for The Atlantic that you mentioned is that I think there's some sense in which when you're going through a major change in your life, maybe going through some kind of crisis that comes along with that change, or even just some very big transformation. For whatever reason, a lot of people find it easy to drop church during that time rather than feeling that they are more in need of the church than ever. I think it's one of the big shifts. For sure.
Jake Meter's with me. We're talking about the article he wrote for The Atlantic called The Misunderstood Reason Millions of Americans Stopped Going to Church. Jake, talk about your background. I talked about mine. You grew up in Nebraska. What was that like? And fast forward to now.
So I still live in Nebraska. I live about 15 minutes from the home I grew up in. I grew up in a very, very fundamentalist kind of church.
Okay.
And I use that term like intentionally. It was independent, non-denominational. We tended to basically view any other churches in town as not really being as committed as us at best, probably not even Christian, certainly didn't regard Catholics as Christian. And in the case, actually, in this church, there was also a number of abuse things going on. Mm. And so most of the kids I grew up with, and this was a church that, like, in the 70s in Lincoln, about 3% of the city attended. And these days, it's far smaller. And basically, the rest of the city doesn't really even pay much attention to it anymore because their reputation's been so shredded by all of these various scandals. Mm. So it was part of what was interesting in talking with Mike and Jim about their book for me was that I'm very primed because of my own experience and the fact that most of the people I grew up with who have de-churched are in the de-churched casualty group. I'm very ready to run with that narrative. And so it was kind of chastening for me in talking with Jim and Mike and looking at the data they have to realize, like, yes, that's a real problem. But the more common problem seems to be that people get busy and they feel as if their busyness has to crowd out something. And so that's going to be church rather than it being like youth sports or brunch with friends or whatever it may be.
Right, right. And I'm sure you have kids yourself, Jake?
We have four.
Okay, so you have four kids. I have two kids. and you have a job, I have two jobs, you might have two jobs or three jobs. So this is, you and I are perfect examples of America today, right? I have two jobs, my husband has two jobs, we have two kids, and it's just tight. Like, we were so excited about this weekend, Jake, only because we had nothing planned. Now, that's pathetic. That's what I would have mocked people for a decade ago. Except things are so crazy that the fact that there's nothing on the calendar is reason for celebration. So these churching numbers or de-churching numbers are something I think all of us feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think for us, like, one of the things that I think young families in particular, the choice we have to make is we have to be willing to prioritize being part of a church ahead of youth sports.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned that before, but yeah, that's a huge influence here, is that particularly if you get into travels, like travel ball for ball or soccer or whatever it might be, travel is code for you're gone on weekends. And so being willing to say no to those things is important. Being confident that you're actually giving your kids something better by being part of a church than you would be by giving them travel ball is important. So I think there's a reality here. There are different phases of life that are going to be more hectic and hard than others. And if your church community is thick and relatively diverse in terms of age and phase, you do need to also be able to talk as a church about, like, I mean, and I think this is how Paul talks in Corinthians. Paul seems to anticipate, for example, that celibate people in the church are going to have more time for ministry than married families will.
Right.
And so I think, like, one thing that we occasionally bump into is a sense amongst older Christians of, well, we kind of did our time having young kids, volunteering, all of that, we're done now. And they kind of pull back from church and they become less engaged. And that actually makes things harder for young families, because then young families don't have the support system around them as they're trying to raise kids and keep them involved in church while also doing all the other things they have to do. And so there's a kind of call here for the young family, for other people going through phases of life where there's disruption and change. But I also think there's a call here for the people to recognize that their stability is, or it can be, an enormous blessing for the people who are not in quite a stable situation.
Right, right.
And you have to have both of those.
Yeah, you really do. We're talking to Jake Meter, editor-in-chief of Mere Orthodoxy, about his article he wrote for The Atlantic, The Misunderstood Reason Millions of Americans Stopped Going to Church. You can check out one of his books, In Search of the Common Good, Christian Fidelity in a Fractured World, or also, What Are Christians For? Life Together at the End of the World. Stay with us. There's much more to come. It's the early week edition of The Ride Home. Earlier in today's program, I talked about a story that's on the front page of today's Washington Post about women getting their hair cut and colored and whatever women have done to their hair. And it traces the price changes that have happened since pre-COVID. So maybe something that you spent $100 on pre-COVID, you're spending $200 on, or maybe something that you spent $200 on, you're spending much more. In fact, the woman that wrote the article in today's Post got a color correction and then went back and got a cut, etc., and a blow dry, and her final bill was $398. I mean, what in the world? Anyway, so it prompted me to think, as I was getting ready for today's show, all right, so I wouldn't spend $398 on my hair, but what are the things that I am always willing to spend money on? Doesn't have to be a lot of money, but what am I willing to pay for? Because some things I'm just not willing to pay for. For example, I just recently bought a car and I ended up with a very nice car, but I didn't spend a lot on my car because a car is not that important to me. I mean, it's fine. It gets me from place to place. I really like the one I got. I feel like I got a good deal on it. Didn't cost me $40,000. It's just not that important to me. However, I am always willing to spend money on things that smell good. So if it's like a candle, if it's, you know, what are the things called, Lexi, that you know, that you put the sticks in, the bamboo sticks in, and they release the fragrance into the air?
I think that's just, it's not incense, but it's similar.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm willing to do that. I love shampoo that smells good. I just, whatever smells good, I am in for. I'm a sucker for it. And so, Lexi, I ask you, what are the things that you're willing to spend money? Now, neither one of us have a ton of money.
No.
I have more money than you because I'm a lot older than you.
Hey, I'm broke.
Right, you're broke. Let's be honest. Right, the life of a radio producer isn't cosmopolitan.
No, and I just got out of college, so we know those student loans are hounding me down.
Yes, they are. But if all things were equal, what are you willing to spend money on?
I am willing to spend money on experiences.
Okay, tell me that.
So I'm willing to spend $80 to $100 on a concert ticket.
Okay.
I'm willing to spend, say, like $60 to $80. Has to be a good meal. And it has to be a meal with friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm willing to spend a decent amount of money on a good meal with a good group of people.
Okay.
I'm willing to spend, unfortunately, way too much money on gas money to drive 3 hours to get to play board games with my friends in Ohio.
Right.
So I'm willing to spend money on experiences, experiencing things in life. So like going to a show, going to a museum.
Yeah.
I like spending money on those things because they're fun.
Right. Okay. So that tells me a lot about you. Now, I already knew that. but thinking about it together, that you're willing to spend money on experiences, speaks a lot to who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that you take, you know, a trip every single weekend to go play D&D with your friends, right? And that's nuts.
It's insane. I don't know why. Sometimes, some weekends I'm like, I don't know why I do this.
Exactly. It doesn't even make any sense.
And then I see my friends and then I'm like, oh, I do understand why.
Okay. Because it's linked to experience.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's really interesting. So I don't know if I can make a meta like judgment about things that smell nice. I'm also willing to spend money on staples, like things that I know, like if you're looking at clothing, things I'm going to wear all the time,
mm-hmm.
like a pair of black pants, a denim jacket, a white t-shirt. You know what I mean? Things that just are going to get worn over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But if you're like a shirt, I'm not going to spend $40 on a shirt.
Yeah, absolutely not.
There's no way.
I just spent $40 on a shirt and then had to return it because I was like, this just wasn't worth it.
Okay, so you did spend it and then you were like, this doesn't go along with my.
Yeah. That's really interesting that.
Oh.
Because for me personally, like if it comes to like a pair of shoes, if it comes to jeans, shirts, I will get them on clearance.
Interesting.
I don't want to spend a lot of money on them. So I think it's. Well, you also probably buy like. Not expensive brands, but brands that are worthy of your money because you know they're going to last a while.
Exactly.
Which I can respect.
I'd rather buy something that's going to last me for a decade. I mean, the jean jacket I'm wearing today, I bought at Goodwill. And I bet I've worn it 1,000 times. It's just like I will have it until I die or, you know, there's an accident and it's lost or burned or something terrible happens.
I think this is what the people online call girl math, where it's you if you're going to buy something.
Yes.
The amount of times you wear it. What is it like divided by the amount that you paid for it is like at some point it's basically going to be free.
The unit cost is so small that I'm willing to do it. Okay, here's another thing I do. When you're talking about experiences, I'm willing to spend money on like landmark things,
mm-hmm.
like someone graduates from high school,
yes.
like my daughter's getting married, like big moments like that. I'm willing to spend money on.
I am too.
Yeah. Are you? So that fits into your experience category.
Yeah, I think so because like in talking with my boyfriend, who hopefully will get married soon. I'm still bothering him about it, but it's fine. But I kind of talk to him sometimes about, you know, things that I want at my wedding, and I'm like, as much as I don't want to spend a lot of money on a wedding. The experience of the wedding will be worth it. That I think the price point doesn't matter a little bit.
Right. And so you can eat in for 50 Fridays,
mm-hmm.
right? And not blow money, not blow $60, $70, $150 going out
mm-hmm.
and think, okay, I spent that money on a day that was really significant.
Exactly.
I like that. It's an interesting question to ask, right? What are we willing to spend money on?
You gotta ask John when he gets back.
I can't wait to. I'm gonna make some guesses and see if I'm right. We're gonna take a break. When we come back, our good friend Karen Swallow Pryor in the On Deck Circle. Are pets people? It's next on today's Ride Home. I come to you today under the auspices of Burton Guster and Princess Charlotte, who are my two cats, who reign supreme in my household.
Those are some big names.
They're big animals, especially Gus, who's sadly very fat. They're 7 years old, and they just enrich my life. That's the best thing I can say. John, you come under the auspices of Clemente, your dog, and Cassini and Ricky, your cats, right?
Exactly.
And our next guest comes under the auspices of her two beautiful dogs, whose names I can't remember at this time, but I bet she's going to tell us in 10 seconds or less. It's Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor, author of On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Literature. Karen, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a long time.
It's sure
good to talk with you both.
I know. We've been missing you. Okay, tell us. You have two dogs, and their names are?
Ruby and Eva.
Oh,
and they're so beautiful. They're Weimaraners, right?
One is a Weimaraner. She's Eva. She's sitting right here. She doesn't get far from me.
Yes.
And the other is a German short-haired pointer.
Excellent.
Oh,
so they
great.
Look very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're an animal lover, Karen, just like we are?
Yes, absolutely.
We were talking in our last segment before the news break that our friend Hugh Ross talks about humans' relationship with animals. And he said that God's designed it in such a wonderful way that the more we relate one to another, animal to human, the more both of our potentials increase, so that we can become more who God created us to be by interacting with animals, and animals can become more of what they were created to be by interacting with humans. And so I find that really interesting. I love that. Like I said, I love animals, but at the same time, there's a difference between animals and people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did not know that quote that you just gave from Hugh Ross. Of course, I know his work, but that is just beautiful and so true. And even that quote itself is pointing out that there is a distinction, and that's how we can, you know, knowing that distinction, bring out the best and a better understanding of who we are, each are as creatures.
Right. But Karen, of course, with all things, we as humans can screw things up. Mm-hmm. A lot of us treat our pets as adults or children, right? I mean, you see that, you know, the bumper stickers, I'm a dog grandma or something like that. I mean, I get it. You want to love your pets, but there is a line here. And that's what you talk about in your Gospel Coalition piece, Pets Aren't People.
Yeah, I mean, I'm speaking, of course, as we've said, as an animal lover,
yes.
Animal lover, and you know, I think there are two things going on. I mean, we see animals being treated as objects and possessions and therefore not treated well, but then we can see them sort of exalted and put in a position where they're taking the place of human beings and human relationships. And that's not right for us, but not right for them either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happens when we invert things like that? What happens when we start to treat our animals, perhaps put them in a place that we should be having other humans in?
Well, I think some people want to say, and I don't want to say this, but I think it's part of the conversation. Some people want to say that they want to find a cause rather than a correlation. And they might say that, you know, you'll see a lot of articles out there about, you know, young Gen Zs and millennials who haven't gotten married and settled down, but they get their pets and they get all the accessories and the strollers and the clothing for the pets, which is a little bit, you know, that's too far. But that does, you know, so they might say that or think that because people have pets, they aren't getting married and settled down. And I think, you know, they're not getting married and settled down for a whole bunch of other reasons. And maybe pets are taking the place of that vacancy or emptiness in their lives. So I want to be careful not to confuse correlation with cause. Mm-hmm. But even so, if you know, I think what prompted my essay was a number of things, but I was mainly quoting from an article at The Atlantic which studies the time that Americans spend. And it just found that people are spending more time with their pets than they were in years past and less time with people. Now, again, that doesn't mean they're spending less time with people because they're spending less time with their pets. But, you know, we're all home more. People are getting more pets. So that could be a reason. But we still have to be careful to keep things in balance and not let the pets take the place of people.
Yes. And in your essay, Karen, you write beautifully about, of course, God knew this. There it is in Genesis about how animals are both like us and not like us.
I think that narrative is so fascinating because, of course, God knew this and he created us and he created animals all in a distinct way. And we're the ones who are made in his image. He allowed Adam to, rather than just telling Adam, oh, you're not like the animals, he allowed Adam to name the animals, bringing them all before him so he could see them, enjoy them, steward them by giving them names. But that it was in that action, that job that Adam could see for himself, that there was no one there for him, none like him. And so it was through engaging with animals that Adam actually realized he needed a companion, which, of course, God already knew, but he was letting Adam see that for himself. I think it's just so beautiful and powerful.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing and a sad thing how we humans can get everything out of whack. There's some things that are just evil, but then there are some things that are good, but then they become not as good or they become evil because they're not in the right proportion in our lives. And the first thing I think of in that regard is work, right? Work is not a curse. The drudgery of work is a curse, but work is a gift given to us, right? But if we put that out of the right proportion in life, all of a sudden we put untold grief onto our spouses and children. We become personally unstable. You name it. You can name all sorts of results of that. But talk about how that can happen with animals, because the good relationship is so good between human and animal that I want to make sure I don't fall into a trap of making it more than it should be.
Exactly. I mean, of course, when we talk about ordered and disordered loves, we're drawing usually from Augustine, who famously writes about this. And I think it's so helpful because, as you said, it applies not just to animals, but to work, to all things in our lives, all good things. When we get them out of order, then that good thing can become a bad thing or a harm. And with pets, it can go either way. If we love them too much or place too high a priority on them at the expense of people or other important things, then our families will suffer. We will suffer. They will suffer. I made a joke in the piece about, people will sometimes send me these things or I'll see them on the internet about, cozy sweaters for chickens. Like, I think if we put a sweater on a chicken, the chicken is going to suffer. It doesn't need the sweater.
Well, so that's one step too far, the chicken sweater.
Right. Now, of course, during the pandemic, you saw all kinds of stories as well. I remember seeing a story about someone who was boarding an airplane with their emotional support peacock. I mean, how do you pick in a peacock on an airplane?
Well, yeah, and I do travel a lot, and I'm not making a judgment here because I don't know that much about it, but I see so many people bringing their dogs on the planes and through the airports, and yeah, I just think to myself, I wouldn't do that to my dogs.
No.
So there are just so many ways we can get things out of order just a little bit or a lot, obviously.
Yes. So the point of your essay is that there is a properly ordered narrative that we should adhere to as believers in Jesus Christ, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a formula. I mean, I had some good feedback to the article because, again, I think some people might have been looking for that cause and effect that people aren't getting married. They remain single because they're, they're getting their companionship needs met with an animal. And I reverse that and I say, maybe these are people who are single. They'd like to be married, but they aren't married. And so that animal, that pet is providing solace and companionship. And that's a beautiful blessing and a gift. And so we can't really look at a situation from the outside and know whether those loves are being ordered properly or disordered properly, but it's just something for us to all think about.
Just think about.
Yeah, and to weigh and consider.
And refrain from assessing each other and pronouncing judgment. I
mean, emotional peacocks notwithstanding.
Exactly.
Dr.
Karen Swallow-Pryor with us. She's the author of On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Literature, amongst other books. Karen, before you leave us, I want to ask about your withdrawal from teaching. No, I mean, you've just decided you're going to pursue other things. Boy, you've been teaching ever since we met. So talk about what that...
This past year.
What that's been like for you.
Yeah. I guess it's been a while since we've spoken. Yeah. So I left my last academic post after 25 years total of teaching in higher education. So I guess that's a good, healthy tenure.
Yes.
And I've moved into full-time writing and speaking, talking on radio programs, and doing that mainly from home, except for obviously when I'm traveling to speak. And it's a new season. I'm working on a new book. I should tell you about my new book if you have the minute. My new book, which will be out next year, is on calling and vocation, which, you know, not coincidentally, is something I've been thinking about in my own life, but obviously been counseling students for years about their callings and vocations.
Yeah.
And and so that will be the subject of my new book.
Fabulous. So in some ways, do you yearn a little bit for the youthful energy that you were surrounded by for a quarter of a century?
I do. I love teaching, and I love especially being in the classroom. I'm doing some other, speaking and writing online, which are forms of teaching. And yet I know I can never go back to sort of my glory days as a young professor being worshipped by students and in classrooms, when I had a full load of teaching and wasn't writing and speaking as much. And so it's been a sort of gradual transition, and the Lord is giving me more opportunities to teach in other ways. And so I'm thankful for them. And I get to spend a little bit more time here with Ruby and Eva.
Right,
as well.
Exactly. What about ordering your day? My husband's been a teacher for his whole career. And he said, when he thinks about not teaching, he thinks that it's going to be so weird for me to not have my day regimented.
You know where you're going to be.
By time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's that been like for you, Karen?
That is a transition, but that also has been a gradual one, because when I first started teaching, I was teaching five classes a semester, and it was very ordered. Eventually, I taught fewer classes. I was given release time for research and writing, and so I've had more pockets of time at home. A professor's schedule is never, the same every day anyway. Sometimes there are morning classes, sometimes afternoon.
Sure.
So it's always been sort of a hodgepodge, and so it hasn't been a dramatic shift, but I feel like I am just getting into it's very hard to manage your time when it's just you by yourself all day.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm just getting into that groove, and it's bringing me a lot of peace and joy.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for it.
And so what's that like? Do you schedule, between these hours, I'm going to sit and write?
I wish I were that disciplined. Someone asked me to write about my writing process, and I'll do that at some point. But every day, some days I have appointments, or I go to the gym 2 days a week. I go to yoga, and so I do those things. And so each day looks different. But I would say, in general, I spend the mornings kind of doing the other things and clearing the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kind of get into my groove in the afternoon and into the evening as I write. And I was never a night person. It's just there's something about that creative process for me that, I have to get everything else out of the way before I can, get my mind
settled,
ready to move. Yeah.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Well, we're really excited for you.
Yeah, Karen.
I mean, I hate to speak on John's behalf, but I think I will.
No, please do. You go right ahead.
We are excited for you. I mean, it's just, you don't have, there are many facets to you, and they're not necessarily attached to a job.
Well, that is true. That's true. And that's easy to to say, for you to say, and it's something I've had to work through.
Sure.
Again, I'm writing about vocation, but I am, you know, and you've given a shout out to my book, but I really want people who are interested in my teaching and my work to find me on my Substack newsletter, which is free to subscribe to. It's called The Priory, and I'm actually teaching British literature, you know, on a weekly basis.
Which is terrific.
Writing little essays.
Right, I'm one of the subscribers there.
Find me there. Yeah, and I'm satisfying the teaching bug that way.
Excellent. That's awesome. Well, Karen, always a pleasure. Good to reconnect.
Great to hear your voice, Karen.
Thanks for having me. Take care, you guys.
That's Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor. She's the author of On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Literature. She also co-edited a book that we don't talk a lot about, but I really enjoyed, Cultural Engagement, A Crash Course in Contemporary Issues. And she's working on a new book on calling and vocation, not letting any grass grow under her feet.
Karen Swallow Pryor. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. It's the Friday edition of The Ride Home.
When it comes to 3D printing, which is like, you know, a thing now, I just can't get it in my head how that's really possible. But believe me, I can understand a 3D printed house a lot more than I can understand what I read about data that was released by the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Columbia University today, because they've created a 7-ingredient slice of cake. Cake, I said, using a 3D printer, and they say printing foods could be a new cooking option with several benefits. This is data that was released in the NPJ Science and Food Journal, and this is what they made. They made a 3D printed peanut butter banana cheesecake with cherry drizzle, which doesn't even sound good. I'm not sure why you'd really want that kind of cheesecake, but whatever. All ingredients in the study were bought from a New York City grocery store. The peanut butter, Nutella, frosting, and cherry drizzle, Lexi, required no additional prep. The bananas did, though, require mashing with a fork so they could fit through the nozzle of a syringe, and the graham crackers were combined with butter and water to create a paste. Now, doesn't that sound tempting? All 7 ingredients then stuffed into the 3D printer and then printed out in layers into the shape of a slice of cheesecake. I want to tell you, from seeing these pictures, there is no one on earth who wants to eat this. I mean, it looks sickening and artificial in every way. Anyway, but the good news, they say, is the researchers see sustainability benefits to printing food because ingredients can be locally sourced, plant-based. These meals can be created with a longer shelf life. And is that the most soulless way you've ever heard food described?
Usually I can see when something isn't made for me but is worth pursuing.
Yes.
I don't think this is it.
I don't think anyone is going to want to eat the graham cracker paste put through the syringe.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy, a production of Salem Media Group.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.